Hello, I'm Julian Barrett.
And I'm Noel Fielding.
We're the Mighty Boosh. Welcome to Monty Python's wonderful world of sound.
Last week, this happened.
Only the shadow knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men.
Your wife, does she go? Hey, know what I mean, nudge, nudge.
I just so happen to have Palin's voluminous diaries with me, the leather-bound originals.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
The guy in there was smoking pot or something and was absolutely out of it, you know.
The first recording of Andre's was in a garden shed at the bottom of his garden, somewhere up in North London.
Your mother was great because she used to bring us sort of cakes. We'd all go out and all pythons sit around on the rockery and eat cake.
Whoa, check me out. I'm all over the spectrum of sound.
And now, a message from the Swedish Prime Minister.
The idea of people buying a record and then wanting to play the favourite sketch for their friends and it's not on the record that they just listened to was just too good to be passed up.
Now let's go on to something ruder.
Wankel rotary entry.
In part two, we'll be talking once more to the Pythons, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, Eric Idle and Terry Gilliam.
But not John Cleese.
No, because he still couldn't remember anything.
About writing songs, about traffic lights.
About the classic cinema in Silbury Hill.
He couldn't even remember upsetting John Denver.
Or about bringing rock and roll to comedy.
Or comedy to rock and roll.
This is Monty Python's wonderful world of sound.
And it is a wonderful world.
First, take the record, then put it on the gramophone, then hit it!
Albatross! Albatross!
Yes, I can help you find the Holy Grail.
Ryan was arrested and taken before a pilot. He sent us to be crucified.
Very good.
I'm not the Messiah. I say you are Lord, and I should know. I followed a few.
Here comes another one.
Remember that tour we did?
Yeah, it's quite difficult to forget. It was 100 dates.
100 dates.
Played the O2, 12,000 people.
Yeah.
Pretty rock and roll.
Yeah, but the Pythons did it 33 years before, 1973.
Did they?
That was the world's first rock and roll comedy tour.
Wow. Yeah, but we have Marilyn Manson's tour bus. I bet they didn't.
No, it's on foot.
John Cleese pushed Palin around in a wheelbarrow.
He doesn't remember that, though. Comedy historian Robert Ross.
He'd all perform live at their respective universities. They'd done the sort of the Footlights and the Oxford shows in Edinburgh before that, but no one had really take a TV success and tour with it.
Eric Idle.
First of all, we did the Arts Theatre in Warwick. We did 3 nights there at Warwick University, and they went crackers. It was a late-night show. They just went completely nuts. It's like when you're first hot in England and the audience don't know each other. They just said, oh, I thought this was our little secret. And then we toured the UK, up the right-hand coast and down the left-hand coast, or vice versa, playing, you know, about 26 dates.
John.
Hello there.
How do you feel about touring, taking the show on tour? Because it's very different. I mean, it's a television show, suddenly going on tour.
Yes, we've done one or two of the items in cabaret before. It's a bit of a risk, but my experience is that the sketches themselves work rather well when they're played against an audience, as it were, instead of sort of being played in a sort of glass case like we do on television. I must say, I always enjoyed doing The Dead Parrot. I know it's... I mean, I really enjoy doing that now. It's terrible. It's getting like those old musical comics that used to do the same act for 20 years.
Huh? I wish to register a complaint. Hello, miss.
What do you mean, miss?
I'm sorry, I have a cold. I wish to make a complaint.
Sorry, my clothes.
Never mind that, my lad. I wish to complain about this parrot, what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique.
Oh, yes, the Norwegian blue. What's wrong with it?
Terry Jones
and Andre Jacquelman.
we were just sort of so thankful to get there because we had this driver who was blind, basically. And he was driving us all. And we eventually realised, because we said he'd drive straight past signs saying, you know, theatre or whatever, or, you know, Basingstoke or something like that. You just passed the turning, you know. And eventually we stuck a map in front of him and said, look, plan the route tomorrow, you know. And we suddenly realised he couldn't see the map.
Braille map.
This is before sat-nav.
How did you travel? Because, like, obviously now it's like, when we did our tour, there's quite a few of us now. Yeah. We've got, like, a big tour bus. It's hilarious. Yeah. We had Marilyn Manson's tour bus, which was quite funny. Yeah. I guess those days, was it?
No, we had various limos, cars, yeah. And this guy, this poor guy, he really couldn't see it.
Dave Howman was brought in by Python record producer Andre Jackelman to play the sound effects.
Here's Dave.
When we first started the tour, we were invited to go in the limos with the other guys, you know, so we did that for a while. And it was so terrible on these bloody limos, and I didn't like that idea. So in the end, we got Andre's van. We went round in Andre's van. And then, unfortunately, it was a Reliant Robin, blue Reliant Robin van. We did a tour, so we were driving this like the Totters. It was amazing.
Neil Innes.
On the road, that's when the kind of the marriage is tested, if you like. You know, because you are in each other's pockets all the time. And I remember one night in Edinburgh on the tour, in the afternoon, we got to Edinburgh fairly early, and Eric and I had gone onto a pitch and putt course with half a bottle of malt whiskey, which we consumed. We did the show, word perfect, but it was noticeably 10 minutes longer. We somehow lost the urgency. And we met David Hemmings in one of the hotels and surrounded by a lot of starlets and whatnot. And we had this kind of game of, like, shove halfpenny of tossing coins up to the closest to the wall. Eric and I stayed for quite a long time with them.
It's hardly rock and roll.
No, that's right. We used to trash the hotel, or well, not quite trash the hotel, but go out leaving the television on, things like that.
We were young men on the road with resulting hotel damage. I think Michael Palin almost destroyed the entire back page of a Gideon Bible once, but he'd had a few. He just ripped it a bit, you know. But he did it deliberately. I saw him.
Michael Palin.
On the first Python tour, we had another guy doing the sound. It wasn't Andre, and he got just incredibly muddled up, just couldn't work it out, and all the mics were on at the wrong time, and Graham would be in the toilet, fully mic'd up, coming out to the audience.
Oh, lot tonight. Coming to Southampton again.
Whilst Eric was on stage sort of mouthing the sketch, and no one could hear it. Because the guy didn't know which of us was which. He had the mic saying Eric, John, Graham, Terry, right, but he didn't know who John... Well, he knew John, I think. He didn't know the two Terrys. He didn't know me and Eric. By process of evolution and elimination of others, that Andre
took over,
took his vice-like grip out of the Python sound.
Actually, but, tried to do a joke like that, didn't we, when we did our live tour. We tried to have the American guy on our show, Rich, to come off stage and leave his mic on a bit too long and have him go... The audience, absolutely, just to slag off the audience. But no one thought it was a joke. They all thought it was a real mistake. So they used to come back on and they'd hate it. We made him try it about 3 or 4 times.
That's cruel.
At the time, though, I mean, the sort of machinery and the stuff to do all that and the technology was quite... It's complex hard. Bit of business, you
it
know,
was,
with a lot
yeah.
of...
We had two Reeboxes playing sound effects through, you know, and invariably the splicing tape would come off.
So it's tape?
The tape,
right,
we were
so
on the
tape loops.
Yeah. And we had leaders in between the cues, and invariably the machines get hot and the tape gets sticky. I'd be cueing a piece of intro music.
Huge machinery, wasn't it?
Yeah, there were, I mean, tons, but you'd hit play and then the tape would go bing, and so you're grabbing the tape and you're pulling the tape through the tape head to play this effect. So while the sketch was going on, I was then busy joining the stuff up, ready.
Eventually we got horses to do that. We'd give Andre a bit more of a break. We invested in a couple of shire horses.
I think it's at Oxford or somewhere. It started off with the wrong speed. It went do 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 do. I thought, no. But everyone laughed. I thought it was part of the show, so it was quite good. I got away with that one.
The great thing about Python, when things go wrong, they think it was done on purpose. You know, that tour was really a lot of fun, and there were some hairy moments.
In February of 1974, they took the show to Drury Lane.
They took it in a bag, didn't they?
Yeah, in a satchel.
My name is Neil Innes, and here am I convincingly walking on the spot just outside the stage door of Drury Lane. And yes, gasp, here we are at last, and let's go inside. Oh! Yes, the same cream paint. They haven't changed the paint in 35 years. It was 1974 when we were here. It was the year of two elections. It's an amazing theatre. Amazing. Actually, it's a funny thing about the stage and the lights in your face. You're not really aware of how far back it's going. I mean, this is amazing with the house lights on. You think, gosh, but you don't, mercifully, you don't see how big it is when you're on stage. They were a lot of fun, but the discipline used to disintegrate after several nights because, A, I think, because the audience knew all the lines and kind of said them another fraction of a second before those who are in the know about comic timing wanted to say them. So it was quite difficult, and I think one particular sketch discipline broke down completely. It was when, between John Cleese and Michael Palin doing the parrot sketch, Cleese would definitely try and make Michael go, you know. And I remember one particular evening, his pining for the fjords was operatic. It was, "Palin for the fjords," and Michael went, you know.
Pining for the fjords!
It was a thoroughly undisciplined show, but I think it was fun. It had to be like that. Everybody knew what was coming next.
Charisma thought it would be a good idea to record The Last Night at Drury Lane and release it as an album.
Here's sound engineer Alan Bailey.
Drury Lane to me on the night was an absolute nightmare. Andre said we would be using Ronnie Lane's mobile studios, and I had never used it before. And so the guy said, "Well, how do you plan on going about this?" And I said, "You know, we record both shows and then we'll cut the best of both together. And they said, "Ah, there's only one show." I said, "Oh, right, well, I'll have to make some very meticulous notes at the rehearsal." Oh, there's no rehearsal.
We had 4 weeks. We were only supposed to do two. We ended up doing four. And by the end of term, you know, sort of pranks were rife. And because it was 1974 and there had been two elections, it was the resurrect the election sketch, the silly election sketch. And it was sort of set up like election night, you know, and Cleese was sort of anchor man. And then you'd have, you know, various people saying, and I had to play the part of Kevin Phillips Bong, and someone else would say, "Silly party." And come out, and Eric would interview me and sort of say, "Well, how do you feel about your defeat?" And I just have to say, "Well, no, I'm not at all downhearted. As I always say, try again, you know." But the awful thing about having to do that meaningless line was I had to have a quick change and put on a raincoat, bowler hat, glued-on moustache and frogman's flippers. It was the frogman's flippers and the panic of getting out there in time for Kevin Phillips Bong, "Silly party. Oh, you were all downhearted by your defeat." And then I thought, last night, I looked Eric in the eye. I said, no, I'm not at all downhearted. As I always say, try again. I looked him in the eye and took the microphone off him and started flapping my way to the front of the stage, saying, "Climb every mountain, ford every stream.
Follow every byway till you find your dream. A dream that will last all the love you can give every day of your life for as long as you live." All together now! "Climb every mountain, falling stream."
A very brave Kevin Phillips Bong there.
It was funny and people laughed, but they decided to keep it on the album. EMI came after them. They hit them for £90,000, which I only found out that, I think, last year when I had supper with Mike and Terry. £90,000.
Yeah, for how many words?
What exactly? I mean, I did three or four full songs. I got nothing like that kind of money.
Terry Gilliam.
They were great fun doing the shows, and Drury Lane, it was terrific, because you know, the fans, the noise of the fan is quite wonderful, and just being on stage and playing around is good, but to me, they weren't, you know, for me, the most exciting things. I always used to get a bit bored. I don't like repetition. And you're doing a show night after night, despite the fact that people are standing and cheering, isn't to me, that enjoyable. I mean, after a while, it's just, you know, you raise your eyebrow, you know, you get a laugh. You don't raise your eyebrow, you don't get a laugh. And I think, where's the fun in that?
You'd have sort of like 1,500 people sort of saying, I wish to register a complaint, you know, before he'd said anything.
One of them had to walk out on stage and say, good day, Bruce. Yeah. And there'd be an uproar, you know. Yeah. Oh, wonderful, we love this sketch, you know. Yeah. Or, I wish to make a complaint.
Yeah. You could almost see the audience mouthing the words as though they were doing it.
It's extraordinary, because they know it all. They knew the words and they wanted to hear it. John Cleese forgot and took a prompt from the audience one night. I mean, they knew it all. I mean, they really did. That happened right up to our final tour. We did the Hollywood Bowl, and 8,000 people there every night. They were just... they knew everything. And it was wonderful.
The Pythons were the world's first rock and roll comedians.
What does that mean?
I think the interesting thing is you seem to draw a rock audience, which is the first time that comedy has ever really done this.
We've always drawn a younger kind of audience. I mean, I think it's from sort of 15 to 26 or something like that. It's really the base of our audience. And I'm sure a lot of them are very keen on rock. It's exactly the same age group that the Goons appealed to. You know? But, I mean, I know that we're very popular among all the pop and rock musicians, too. And I know that they try and arrange their shows frequently so they don't actually coincide with Python broadcast, which I think is amazing, but they all tell me that they do.
You had a lot of rock and rollers who were great Python fans.
Yeah.
You sort of hung out with the Stones and stuff, didn't you?
Well, sort of, yeah. Eric was very friendly with Mick and Ronnie Wood and all that. We see them occasionally. It's only rock and roll, but I
like it. I've never thrown pianos out of windows or television sets, but Keith Moon was a good friend, and we spent a lot of nights with him. He came on holiday to Barbados when we were writing The Life of Brian, and he'd sit on the beach waiting for us to finish writing so he could play with us. You know, I spent nights jamming with Keith Richard, losing my voice on movies. Floyd, I hung out with for a while. Roger Waters, a brilliant man. Mick Jagger, been on cricket tours with. You know, they're just our generation, and they're the best and finest of our generation. The Townsends, you know, intelligent people who somehow got sucked into rock and roll.
The George Harrison thing, the Beatles, was a great thing.
Because they were quite big.
We grew up absolutely. I mean, they were, weren't they? Massive. After that, you know, difficult early period sort of, in the 60s.
That's all quite always kind of fries your mind a little bit, when you, because for us, like with the, you know, obviously the Pythons, a bit like the comedy Beatles, if you're a comedian, it's like, and if you're in a band, it's the Beatles are like this. But the two together is always...
Well, for us, it's, I mean, in the 60s, just before we did Python, I mean, Terry and I absolutely... I mean, we worshipped the Beatles. I mean, not worship, but we just saw that and thought they were so brilliant because they tried doing different stuff each time, new material. Their album's incredibly complex.
Yeah.
And it turns out that 10 years later, one of them, you know, George Harrison, gets The Life of Brian made by putting up the money. It's just an unbelievable turnaround.
And he's actually got a little cameo, hasn't he? He's in...
George.
Life. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Papadopoulos. He's given us the mount. Yeah. The awful thing was I have to dub his voice.
Did he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But I couldn't hear him properly. Sort of, yes, yeah, you can have the mount.
Appropriately enough, in 1974, Python even recorded a special flexi-disc for the New Musical Express called Monty Python's Tiny Black Round Thing.
This Tiny Black Round Thing comes to you with the compliments of New Musical Express. In the interests of promoting world peace and increasing mutual understanding between the nations of the free world. It is not in any way an attempt to boost sales of the paper in a year of increasing competition, or a cheap gimmick to attract people away from disc or melody maker. The record is introduced personally by the head of New Musical Express Limited.
Good evening! First, take the record, then put it on the gramophone. Then hit it with a needle. Hit it. Go on. Play. Oh, I like being head of New Musical Express. I like it. I got my own chair and the table which I hit. I'm very famous.
It was like a rock band. It was great. It felt good, you know. Dunk, dunk, dunk. I mean, that's why I got bored eventually, because after the initial buzz of being part of a rock band, you know, same old stuff.
By now, sketches like the Parrot sketch, Nudge Nudge and the Lumberjack song have become fan favourites on account of their release on vinyl.
By that stage, 74, 75 time, the shows had been so popular, and thanks mainly to the records, you could play the sketches over and over again in your bedroom and memorise the Dead Parrot and Spam or whatever.
I never thought of that. You know that? It was that far before
video.
Video. God, the modern history of the world has moved so quickly.
Absolutely.
And yet we're so young and still so...
Vibrant.
Virile. I mean, that's right, because this is... The records were also the thing that hit America before the television got there. And that was quite critical in whatever success we experienced when the shows finally reached America. People knew the records and they'd been playing them and hearing them. For me, they reminded me of the Goon Show when I was living in America, and suddenly the Goon Show came over on record, and I, oh, what's that? And I think the Americans were having the same response to the Python albums coming over to America. What's this? Who's this? And we were being romanced by the top record people because they liked the albums, and then they discovered we were, you know, a show on television as well, and then, woo, hello.
When we first came to America, they thought we were just a recording group. And they only had heard the albums. When we first came down to California, we were on all these radio stations promoting the albums because they had no idea there was a TV show attached. I think Terry Jones and I did Nudge Nudge on a rock and roll show, which got played and played and played and repeated over 20 years because it was a rock show, basically. So all these kids knew Nudge Nudge sketch as if it was kind of a song. They was always very, very familiar with that.
Where are we?
We've come to the Classic Cinema in Silbury Hill, an entirely fictitious cinema. Popcorn?
No, thanks. Why are we in a toilet?
This is where the album of the soundtrack of the trailer of the film of Monty Python and the Holy Grail mainly takes place.
Really? But I thought soundtrack albums usually contain soundtracks. You know, the music, maybe a bit of dialogue.
Not this one. Well, about half.
About half?
Mm.
Well, what about the other half?
The album of the soundtrack of the trailer of the film of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Live from the Classic Silbury Hills.
Hello and welcome to the Classic Silbury Hill for the 3:10 performance of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I can see through the door of the gentleman's that the B feature, Bring Me the Head of Don Reeve, has only a few minutes left to run, just time for me to tell you a few quick words about the theatre. The Classic Silbury Hill, formerly the social club of the Andover Parks and Burials Department, was converted into a cinema in 1941 by Ken Paulson, father of John, in the Gothic Renaissance style. The lavatories here comprise two freestanding fixtures and a 12-inch enamel wall bar with self-rinsing bar and auto-sump grill, and were opened by Gary Cooper in 1957.
Oh, there you go.
Sounds like I was the only one available.
Mike wasn't on holiday.
I've forgotten all about that.
That's why I think those my favourite albums are certainly the soundtrack ones because you just don't expect.
It's
always surprises. Yeah.
As you say, it was all add-ons to the film and everything. You know, it was never just the film soundtrack or anything like that.
That would be quite boring, wouldn't it?
Fairly boring. Yeah.
Sounds really fresh. This is such a good idea.
Ken Paulson, father of John. Because John Paulson was in the news for a while because he was an architect who, wasn't he, or something, or a town planner who did some dodgy deals. And now completely unknown, and yet he's been sort of...
Immortal.
He's remembered on this album through his father, Ken. I mean, I quite like that because people will say, oh, well, that blew over. And a few people somewhere will say, God, that's John Paulson.
Look, everyone, it's Robert Ross.
It's not what you think. I mean, having seen the film, you think, OK, it's going to be lovely, sort of like, you know, our record of the best bits. It's probably about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, if that, of the film. Most of it is just like going to the cinema, Silbury Hill, to see this screening of the film. It's, again, playing with the conventions of what you expect to buy when you buy a soundtrack record. You want the film, and you don't get it with this.
Yeah, I think it was just the idea of sort of making the soundtrack of the film into something else and actually trying to do something with it. We just sort of thought it'd be more fun to do, you know, to mess it around and actually, you know, put in some new stuff. And why just have the soundtrack?
Which is quite boring on its own to listen to. So you do the... Yeah. And it also enabled us to actually skip through sections of the movie to keep it moving.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Well, the classic Silbury Hill is very fortunate in having entirely adequate parking facilities adjacent to the cinema. The car park itself has an asphalt base, rimmed with a 4-inch concrete strip sunk into shale and brick nogging to a depth of 6 feet. The parking area can accommodate up to 65 vehicles arranged in a crescent formation. Typical of the skill of architect Una Bolson, mother of Ken, father of John, is that the park is self-draining. Over to you, Dougie.
And here we are back with the film as Arthur approaches another castle. 170 to 180 feet high, I should say, with an inner and outer bailey in the...
Oh, shut up! Oh.
The Python's first film soundtrack gave him a few headaches.
Well, originally, Neil Innes was doing the music.
Oh, okay.
And he did it all, you know, egged on by me and Terry. He did it all on genuine medieval instruments and made it sound very medieval.
Bravely bolts a robin brought forth from Camelot. He was not afraid to die. Oh, brave Sir Robin. He was not at all afraid to be killed in nasty ways. Brave, 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 brave Sir Robin. He was not in the least bit scared to be mashed into a pulp, for to have his eyes gouged out and his elbows broken, to have his kneecaps split and his body burned away, and his limbs all hacked and mangled, brave Sir Robin. His head smashed in and his heart cut out and his liver removed and his bowels unplugged and his nostrils raped and his bottom burnt off and his penis...
That's enough music for now, lads.
Terry was away, and I did the first mix of the film, and I was obsessed by the atmosphere, the sound, and I built it up, very rich sound landscape. And we had a screening, and I'd overcooked it, and the screening was disastrous. It was terrible.
We showed it to, like, 200 people, and then they invested, most of them were investors, so we had Pink Floyd there and Led Zeppelin and Michael White, and everybody put money into the film. And it all started off, the first 5 minutes, everybody laughing very sort of hard, and then nothing. Absolute not a titter throughout the film. And we were sitting there going, what's going on?
And so Terry went back and stripped everything out, just stripped it out. And then I had to sneak back in and put some bits back in. So the end result is definitely a tug of war between Terry and me.
On the Holy Grail record, the Pythons were again pushing the boundaries of the medium, including the boundaries of taste.
Oh, Jeb, why did you do it? You could have destroyed the tapes and none of this left is backlash.
An excerpt from Carl French's latest film. Carl, we're all a little mystified by your claim that your new film stars Marilyn Monroe.
It does, yes.
Who died over 10 years ago.
That's correct.
Are you lying?
No, it's just that she's very much in the public eye at the moment.
Does she have a big part?
She is the star of the film.
And dead?
Well, we dug her up and gave her a screen test, a mere formality in her case, and...
Can she still act?
Well, she still has this enormous, a kind of indefinable, no.
Was decomposition a problem?
We did have to put her in the fridge between takes.
What sort of things does she do in the film?
Well, we had her lying on beds, lying on floors, falling out of cupboards, scaring the children.
But surely Miss Monroe was cremated?
Well, we had to use a stand-in for some of the more visible shots.
Another actress.
A dead actress, but Monroe was in shot the whole time.
How?
Oh, in the ashtray and a fire grate and a vacuum cleaner.
So Marilyn does not appear in the film?
Not as such.
falling out of cupboards.
Yes, well,
yeah. You got away with a bit more on the records, I suppose.
Yeah. Was that before or after Derek and Clive and all that sort of stuff was around? People used to
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I think it was sort of around about the same time, wasn't it, I think? It was definitely easier to write that sort of stuff for a record than film or TV.
Less people looking over your shoulder when you're making stuff.
Yeah, but we just had little... But like Python, when we made the first series, there was really a lot of fragments and it wasn't sketch following sketch. It was little ideas that just sort of ran for a short while, could then go to animation or something like that. So this was a sort of oral equivalent of that. You know, we could just try throwing little bits, see where they... got to, but I must say, listening to it today, I'm quite surprised and impressed how much was sort of ad-libbed, had that.
Yeah.
You know, we just tried it out at the time, see how it worked. Oh, that's great.
I'm quite surprised.
And also Graham. I mean, Graham's got
great voice for
radio. It's just, he just knew what made something funny, you know, the right, you know, never laugh at your own things. In fact, it's made me want to go and do another album.
Okay, let's go.
Graham? You really?
Hello?
Graham.
There's definitely an air of freedom on the records which wasn't in place on TV. You always had this sense that Auntie Beeb was reining them in a bit, whereas Charisma Records pretty much let them run wild.
It's funny, I didn't think it consciously that we were thinking, oh, well, now we're free, we can go and say dirty words. I mean, just, that was the way we did it. It's just, push it. We always were pushing, and so if you've done it one way, why not go a little bit further? I was always curious to see how far we could go before we got nailed. It just intrigues me. I just don't know where the edge of the world is, so let's keep going until we fall off.
We're the Mighty Boosh, and this is Monty Python's Wonderful World of Sound.
With their next project, some thought the Pythons pushed things a little bit too far.
How so?
Watch this.
The film has generated a bit of controversy. Just about every religion on the planet has lodged a complaint against the film. Did you expect a sort of fracas to come about as a result of The Life of Brian?
Yes, I don't think we anticipated the directions it would come from. I mean, the several Jewish organizations that... were the first to complain. I would never in a million years have expected that. I must say that was a... And the fact that they were complaining about the stoning sequence was a total revelation to me.
It's a little odd, because it's just a piece of history, really.
What surprised me was the intensity of the reaction. I mean, not just condemning it, but saying... I think somebody went to printers saying that the film could lead to violence, which I thought was a very strange and rather irresponsible statement, which I just don't know what he could mean by that.
I think he should be taken out and beaten up.
For The Life of Brian, the songs are getting more ambitious. And they called in music lecturer John Dupre to help with the title track.
Brian, the babe they call Brian.
Andre said, well, we're going to make a demo for the... For Life of Brian, of this thing called the Brian Song. So I remember going in there about 2 o'clock, and I staggered out about 11 o'clock, having done sort of 16 trumpets, 15 French horns, all the piano, and a lot of things. And I thought, well, that's the end of that. There was a phone call about a week later, and Andre said, the boys like it. Will you come in and meet them? So I went down there about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they were all in there, the whole team. And Andre played this demo back, cranked up very loud on the loudspeakers, and the atmosphere was absolutely electric. They were all there, and it was very loud, all these trumpets and French horns. And it sounded quite good. So we thought, right, well, let's get some real trumpet players in to replace all this stuff that I demoed. And so we hired, one of these sort of big pit bands from the Locarno or something like that, and they couldn't play it. They couldn't make the high note, and it didn't sound very good. So my demo that I did that afternoon ended up on the film. That's what you hear. So that was my sort of baptism of fire.
No girl named Brian, not a girl named Brian.
You do it the proper way, you spend the money the way you should, which is supposed to deliver the optimum version of something,
and it doesn't have the same spirit. There's something in the, like the demo had a spirit. You can't put your finger on it, but it is, it's got something there. And then you do the other thing, which is, which should be better, and it isn't.
Soundtrack album for The Life of Brian couldn't be more different from The Holy Grail. Here comes Robert Ross.
Some things in life are bad, they can really make you mad.
Life of Brian is the complete opposite to The Holy Grail album. Life of Brian is the record of the film. I mean, there's very little new stuff on here. Andre Jacquemin sort of picked out all the best bits of the film, and there's sort of a vague linking. But this is the film, really.
Always look on the bright side of life.
And I suppose in 1979, when you saw the film, obviously caused so much controversy. EMI had pulled out and handmade films had been created by George Harrison and Dennis O'Brien to finance the film. There's nothing adventurous at all here. This is just, you know, just bits from the film, good though they may be.
The soundtrack album from the movie... I remember the soundtrack album from Holy Grail, I guess, was the same. You don't only put the background music as most soundtrack albums, but you actually have the dialogue from several of the scenes in the film on the record. Are you involved in the process of what is selected to work on the record as well?
Yes and no.
Yes. I mean, yeah, we do.
Or no.
Python.
Yes or
no? The yes bit of it.
Deal with the yes bit first, and then Graham will explain that.
I'll be able to. Sort of, you know,
okay. The yes bit is that we are all involved in as far as listening to what someone might have put together, but we don't all go into a recording studio and say we're definitely going to have this or that, because there wasn't really time. Happened with this one was that I made a sort of compilation. And we actually made a live album one time. We went and recorded an audience in England listening to the film. And that was listened to, and it was felt it didn't really work terribly well. I'd gone on holiday by that time. Then Eric took over and made another selection, which is, I think, the one we've got at the moment. I mean...
Have you heard it?
Yes,
I've heard it.
You've heard it.
Well, if you were home right now listening to the radio, you would be hearing it.
Yeah.
Right now.
Link. It just says link here, but it doesn't say anything else.
I'm sorry, yes. I'll deal with this, Nigel.
Can you?
Yes, he just wants to know what's going on.
Link.
Yes. This is just
might be leak.
No, it's link. We just wanted you to link all the bits together. You see, what we've got is a film.
Yes, I
and,
see.
And it doesn't make much sense, just on a record.
More for you.
Well, yes. Luckily, it's a sort of nonsense type comedy group who are doing this, doesn't really matter. You know, the kids tend to like this sort of stuff.
Yes.
But what we really need to do is link a few of the odd scenes together.
Right.
And
we want you to
do it.
Yes. Fine.
Good.
But I will need a few of the words written down for me.
So Kevin's got the words.
Normally they do that sort of
Yes, he's got the words.
Has he?
Yes.
I never heard that bit. What's that bit doing? I think you should have told us that bit.
That was done while you were on holiday.
Oh, I see.
Now this bit was done while I was on holiday.
Yeah.
But this was when Graham had come back from holiday, and he and Eric got together and had a few, didn't you? You know,
a few, yes.
Yeah, a bit of that going on. You know,
a few of them.
Yeah.
And you just ad-libbed it, didn't you?
Absolutely. Weeks of writing.
Spontaneous.
Went into that.
Well, do you mean to say, Graham, that there are some bits on the soundtrack album of Monty Python's Life of Brian that are not actually in the movie? There
only very brief bits that hopefully explain some of the visual sequences that are missing. And one or two extremely silly bits of self-indulgence.
Brian is arrested and taken before Pilate, where he is sentenced to be crucified.
Yes, could you do that one just once more? Make it a bit lighter, please.
What?
A little bit lighter.
Lighter?
Yeah.
Silly? Sort of?
No. just lighter, okay?
Right.
Brian is arrested and taken before a pilot. Where he is sentenced to be crucified.
Yes, I think that had many things going for it. Do you think heavier is
right.
the keynote?
You'd rather go back to
yes,
the heavier.
I...
Brian is arrested and taken before Pilate, where he is sentenced to be crucified.
Very good.
I think we did concentrate quite hard on Life of Brian to make it interesting. And it wouldn't be just fair to run the soundtrack. You know, not on a Python
but
album. Anyway.
But it was really Andre was taking over more and more of it. I think we were drifting away.
Yeah, which is why that one isn't as good as that one.
I mean, I was doing my films, and everybody was going in different directions, so it all ended up more and more on Andre, and who happened to be passing by at the time.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, since Mike had invested money in Andre's recording studio, Mike would always turn up.
Yeah, no, that's right. Which is why sometimes it got to the point where we'd be recording half a sketch, and then we'd have to pick that up when somebody was next in town or whatever.
There was no getting away from it. The Pythons were beginning to drift apart.
They'd all gone to other things. I mean, John Cleese had just done the second and last series of Fawlty Towers to great acclaim. Michael Palin was about to embark on films for Handmaid, like A Private Function and The Missionary and those sort of things. Terry Jones was directing films. Terry Gilliam was directing films, just about to do Time Bandits and that sort of thing. Eric Idle was doing Rutland Weekend Television and The Ruttles. So really, there was no time for them to get together in a studio and do marvellous, lavish sketches around little bits from their old film. All they had time for, really, was to do the film with Graham and Eric linking it.
Thank you very much for coming along. I think the voiceovers have helped the record enormously.
That's it, is it? I mean, that really is it?
Yes, thanks. That's all we need, thanks.
Oh, OK.
Is £30 all right?
Why not buy the new Monty Python gramophone record called Monty Python's Contractual Album now? Well, I don't know. Perhaps you're tied up for a few minutes, or you're not near a record shop, or perhaps you think the Monty Python group are untalented, overpaid and boring, or perhaps you've already got it. I mean, how should I know? It's ridiculous. Anyway, sorry, this is such a bad commercial. At least it's better than the record. No, I didn't mean that. I mean, the Monty Python Contractual Obligation album is at least as good as this commercial. Nearly, if not better. Thank you.
The Contractual Obligation album was essentially a collection of songs and was the last time the Pythons all contributed new material to a record.
Why was it called the Contractual Obligation album?
Now, why we're here is because you've got a new album on release called the Contractual Obligation album. Why?
Well, that's precisely what it is. We had a contractual obligation to make another album, and so we thought we'd call it that and be honest. Although it's a curiosity, isn't
it? It is, isn't it? Yes.
It's a curiosity that I think this is one of the few albums with all totally original material on it.
Yes, except for the old 1948 sketches and the...
yes, apart from a few.
Does this mean that you didn't want to make an album?
Oh, no, it doesn't mean that. We quite wanted to.
We were mad keen to. I was terribly keen. I was the keenest of the whole group, actually, to make the album, apart from Eric and Mike and John and Greg was... very keen. A bit keener than me, weren't you?
Yes.
But I wasn't that keen, was I?
No, you were at least keen to begin
with.
Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
The Contractual Obligation album was... we did have a contractual obligation for with Charisma to supply them one more record, and nobody was felt like writing comedy, so we came up with something. We came up with the idea of doing songs.
That was 1980. Were you all a bit comedied out? But
1980, was it? No, I think it was just getting together to actually write stuff. I mean, at least songs you could do, like, you know, sitting in my car humming into a dictaphone, you know, and
was it getting more and more difficult to get you all in the same?
Yeah, it was getting hard to. But I mean, we did actually meet up to actually vet the songs, and people would say yes or no.
I really don't remember at this point being as interested, because I don't think any of us were in some strange way. I mean, we're always honest about our titles, and you know, so nobody was really writing sketches. So we had these songs. So let's fill up an album with this stuff.
And I think that was mainly sort of Eric's driven. Area, wasn't it, really?
Eric loved music and any song. I mean, just he's good. He's just great lyricist and
good
John
guitar.
Dupre, and then they put things together beautifully.
I think I might have encouraged people to write songs because people were a bit tired of writing sketches at that point, and we'd moved into writing movies. We were no longer writing for television. And so I think I might have suggested, let's do some songs.
It was great. I mean, we all liked, having said we weren't terribly confident in our singing, we all loved
to have a go. I think apart from John, we all really liked music.
It wasn't sort of John's world, was it? Pop music, really.
No.
I remember when we were doing
official... Boy George was called George Boy, do you remember?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Chapter,
yeah.
Yeah. Hello, George Boy.
John Dupre took more of a role in Contractual Obligation after a bizarre trumpeting accident.
I burst my lung. Which I went up to a wedding in the Highland to play for my nephew's wedding, and I was playing it wasn't the trumpet voluntary, it was the pom 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 pa bum pa bum pa bum. Anyway, I burst my lung and ended up in intensive care in Inverness Hospital. I sort of came round there. It's not a good place to burst your lung, by the way, because it's a long drive. And when I came round, I was wired up to all these machines and ECGs and all that sort of stuff going beep, and I remember a nurse came in with a little silver tray, and on it was a telegram. And it was from Michael Palin, and he said, "We heard about your accident. We're terribly sorry. You know, hope you get well soon. Best wishes, Michael Palin." I was employed by London University as a music lecturer at that time, and absolutely nothing from them. And so I thought, I looked at all these machines, and I thought, life is very short. Quit your job. Try and make it as a composer. So I did. It was that experience and Michael Palin's kind telegram that changed my course of history.
I got a stitch once and I was playing a harmonica, but imagine your lungs exploding. I didn't even know you could have a trumpet accident. Ridiculous.
When it came to the Contractual Obligation album, I had a sort of series of phone calls from all the others giving me the songs that wanted to go on this album. I remember John Cleese, his contribution was the Oliver Cromwell song. And I remember getting a phone call and saying, we've got John Cleese on the phone for you. Will you take the call? And I said, yes. So he eventually got to the phone. And he said, I did this thing in Cambridge called the Oliver Cromwell song. I'm not doing the voice very well. It was set to a piece of piano music. And it went... He said, do you think you could track it down and find out what it was?
Also, the album's mainly songs, and that's a new direction for Monty Python, is it not?
Yes, it is. Half of us at least can't sing, which makes it difficult.
It's mostly our top half.
Yeah.
Which is the singing bit, you know. That's unfortunate thing.
Unfortunate, that.
Graham's very good with his lower legs. I mean, you know, from the singing.
Singing with his lower legs.
Yes. Yes, yeah. I'm a sort of bass, really.
Yes.
I suppose you'd describe that.
Where exactly does it come out? Could you perhaps indicate to us?
But it's like, you know, like grasshoppers, basically, isn't it? He sort of gets there and has to have his trousers off, of course, to do this.
Yeah. You do?
Oh, it was a closed recording session.
And he kind of rubs them together, and he gets the right resonance for the room. Of course, it's different in every room. And once he's got his legs really sort of resonating, then you get this very rich bass sound comes out. It's wonderful to see.
That's when we began to record more songs. And I think some things like Finland of Michael came out from that.
Finland, 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 the country where I want to be, pony trekking or camping.
They're very nice because John and I would take Finland and then John would arrange it in the South American style, which I love. It's a song about Finland done with South American music. So we pushed it a bit more there because we didn't really care about the album.
I Like Chinese was interesting because Eric said, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a verse in Chinese? And I replied, well, I only know Mandarin. I had a degree in Mandarin Chinese from Oxford. And so he said, well, that would be all right. So I translated it into Mandarin, which is fairly easy. Wo ai zhongguoren, wo ai zhongguoren, wo ai zhongguoren. Ni hao ma, ni hao ma, ni hao ma zai jian, which means hello, hello, goodbye.
I like Chinese. I like Chinese.
It was number one in Australia and banned in Birmingham. And we had, on the last tour, we had a lady walk out. But of course, it's terribly complimentary, like, about the Chinese. I mean, it's a sort of pion to their brilliance. So there's nothing derogatory there.
Two tracks on the album raised eyebrows. The first track, Sit on My Face, was sung to the tune of Sing As We Go, a song made famous by Gracie Fields in 1934.
Sing as we go, let the world go by.
sing as we go and let the world go by, dear. And that's a real 40s wartime song, which we transmute into Sit on My Face and Tell Me That You Love Me.
Sit on my face and tell me that you love me. I'll sit on your face and tell you I love you.
And I remember recording that, and we had all these proper BBC singers came in, the Fred Toms, and we said, yeah, just here we go, and we played the track. And then off they sang, and as they sang, Sit on My Face, we just fell over. I just disappeared behind the console and laughed myself silly. It was the silliest thing. And at the end, they were going, oh, it's a bit strong, isn't it? You can't say this, you can't. Oh, what do you think? Oh, I think it's a bit filthy. That was a joy.
Farewell to John Denver contained a few bars of John Denver's track Annie's Song,
which sounds like this.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest.
Followed by the sound of John Denver being strangled.
The item which follows has been omitted on legal advice.
It was just a little item with John Denver singing, and then he's strangled because we hated John Denver. And it was one of the few times Python was ever censored, and Denver didn't take the joke well, and his lawyers got onto us, and we ended up having to pull it off.
Once again, we apologise for that pause in the record, which was owing to the original item being omitted on legal advice. However, I'm pleased to say we can now go on with the record.
So, no.
Yeah?
What's your favourite comedy song?
It would have to be Here Comes Another One.
Mm.
Oh, it's powerful.
It sort of transcends comedy songs in a way, because it's something beyond comedy and beyond music.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
It's almost a kind of symphony.
Here comes another one. Here it comes again. Here comes another one. When will it ever end?
That's it, is it?
Obviously, it would be better with a full orchestra.
Yes. Yes, I suppose it would.
Here comes another one.
One tune I cannot forget off the album is called Here Comes Another One.
Ah, yes, an excellent melody, that one, yes.
Yes, Terry wrote that.
You wrote it?
I'm sorry, no, I don't want to be caught like this.
No, it is very good.
It is, good. Isn't it? Yes.
To hell with modesty, can't I?
Really?
Here comes another one.
Here comes another one.
Yes,
it's amazing. I love that.
Strokes of genius.
I've forgotten that.
Yeah. Here comes another one. So catchy.
Oh yeah.
Here comes another one.
That was from Terry. You know, these soulful little. Someone will write a book about Terry Jones' soul lyrics and ballads.
I love Contractual Obligation. I think it's my favourite album. I really like Traffic Lights, and I like Finland.
I mean, I really like the Cheese Emporium. It's very good. Matching Tie and Handkerchief.
I really liked Live at Drury Lane. I thought that was amazing. It sounded really exciting. When I was a kid, I used to think, what was this? I'd love to have been there.
Albatross.
It was
a bit of a revelation.
And Chapman wrestling himself was incredible.
Mm. I mean, I had them all on tape. And they were very sort of precious objects, which I would trade and swap with various other kids at school and stuff.
I remember carrying mine around in my school bag to sort of show off a bit.
Yeah.
People go, what's that? Like, it's Monty Python.
Just happened to have it in my bag, you know.
Live at Drury Lane.
Well, that's what I listened to, you know.
And the swearing on it.
Yeah.
I avoided a few beatings by producing Live at Drury Lane.
Yeah.
I was about to be set upon.
By John Cleese,
yeah. He can't remember any of it, though.
Yeah. I didn't listen to them for a long time because they were too powerful and influenced, so I had to sort of deny their existence for a good long while, and then when you put them back on again now, you sort of realise how much stuff they'd done, how much ground they covered now.
How influential.
Yeah, and how much we've ripped them off.
Well, I was going to ask you another question now. Oh, take a new tack, as
hold
it were.
On. Okay, right.
Is this okay? Am I all right for taking a new tack now?
Yeah.
Is this perhaps the last time that the whole team will work together?
No!
It never is.
No!
It never is. People keep wondering that, but it never has been so far.
Yeah. As long as Graham keeps taking the medicine.
Yeah.
But it was the last time they'd all worked together on record.
That's really depressing.
No, no. I mean, after Python, Michael Palin became an explorer. John Cleese made business training videos under Fishical Wonder. Terry Jones got very interested in the Middle Ages. Eric Idle moved to LA and became a theatre impresario.
Terry Gilliam made some films.
Graham Chapman joined the Dangerous Sports Club and attempted to hang glide over a volcano in Ecuador.
But no more albums.
No more albums.
Maybe they could just do one more.
I mean, it's quite a good idea, actually. I mean, at least we could get together to make a record album.
Yeah, and that's easy, isn't
that's easy.
There's something about comedy records that is quite special. I don't know what it is. I think they're quite cool, especially, and they don't seem to date for some reason way as television.
No, that's right. Especially like listening to some of these things again is that they could have been recorded last week.
There's something about records in general where you don't, it doesn't matter if they're 20 years old. Yeah, they're sort of
we don't see the styles, we don't see the haircuts.
No, that's right. Well, the good news is then we're going to do another album and I'm going to get another £200. Great!
Have you got any money?
I've got what do you mean?
Well, we could pay Jackerman.
I haven't got £200. I've got £12.
I've got €14. Do you think Jackerman will go for it?
That's not going to do it.
No?
Jackerman won't go for that.
Jackerman doesn't get out of bed for less than £200.
No. I've got an Oyster card I could chuck in.
I've got a tuna sandwich. I think Jackerman will go for it.
He'd go for that, won't he?
Mm.
He likes tuna.